Hello, and we continue our podcast series, The Role of Law and Corporate Actors. And today I'm honored to have as our guest Anita Ramasastry, Professor of Law and Director of the University of Washington Sustainable International Development Graduate Program, the OSCE Special Representative on Combating Corruption, and the former UN Working Group on Business and Human Rights member. And dear Anita, thank you very much that you agreed to participate in this podcast series. And my first question to you, actually, how do you see the connections between these concepts or frameworks on anti-corruption, on the rule of law, and business and human rights? Because it's not a very common situation when we discuss this concept together.
Great. Thank you so much, Elena, for inviting me to join this conversation, this important conversation. I'll first say that really what we need to think about both now, currently in a situation of conflict, but in post-conflict, when we think about Ukraine's recovery and reconstruction, there is a lot of money that is being spent, a lot of resources on issues. Right for now, it is, of course, dealing with the war. And of course, in the future, it will be around construction, reconstruction, rebuilding in Ukraine. So when you see large amounts of money changing hands, right, the private sector will actually have both locally, right, lots of Ukrainian companies, but lots of international companies, opportunities to win big contracts. And what we see is both in times of conflict and in times of post-conflict, when there are large amounts of money being spent in situations that are time sensitive. So, you know, we need to get weapons distributed quickly or defense equipment. And in the reconstruction phase, right, it will be very important to the Ukrainian people to have the economy functioning well again and to have, right, new construction. So when those things happen, right, they often procedures and corners are cut. This is traditional, and we've seen this in many different places. We can look more recently at, for example, Iraq or Afghanistan as those situations. There are many opportunities because often there's not a solid basis, an institutional set of mechanisms to oversee the spending of this money. So how do these different concepts relate? Well, the first one, strong rule of law. When we're talking about lots of contracts being issued by the government, lots of contracts being issued to companies, then we need strong courts that will not only make sure that contracts are properly enforced, but when there is fraud, when there is abuse of government procurement, when there is corruption, that you actually have well-functioning courts, anti-corruption agencies that can help oversee and prevent the harm, right? Because again, once the money is gone or if the money is wasted, right, then the consequences are, you know, right now, a matter of life, right? And in the future will again make a difference in a vibrant economy. Second piece is you need strong safeguards to prevent corruption. We need that on a daily basis, but when the amount of money that is being spent so quickly, the opportunities and the incentives for corruption are much higher, right? We're not talking about paying a petty bribe to get access to, you know, your customs clearance, right? These are big multi-million billion dollar contracts. So anti-corruption, rule of law, and third, and maybe that's the topic that people don't think about, but they should, is business and human rights or responsible business conduct. The companies that will get the benefit of these contracts, again, local Ukrainian companies and big international ones, are getting a tremendous opportunity. And we need to remember that. And so what kind of companies do we want to award those contracts to? Responsible ones. Because again, we want the construction projects to be done by companies that respect the rights of workers, right? We want not forced labor, not with unsafe conditions. We want to ensure that the companies that are coming in will protect the rights of their customers. So, I mean, I can talk about more issues, but just to say that it's also a piece of this. So when we talk about responsible business conduct, to me, the three go together: rule of law, anti-corruption, business and human rights.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I see in this point, you know, this principle of policy coherence and the UN guiding principles is mentioning it. But when we see the reality, public sector and private sector prefer to talk about post-war rebuilding, post-war reconstruction without strong mentioning, I would say, responsible business conduct. I agree that anti-corruption agenda is very actually is very on the agenda in Ukraine, but responsible business conduct is still not focus of the attention, and I'm wondering how we can attract this attention to this topic in our society.
Yeah. So I think it's, again, about educating the business community in Ukraine, policymakers, but also just the public about why this is important. And there are a couple of reasons. The first one, which I didn't mention a minute ago, but I should, is that the other risk in the reconstruction piece is that the people who get awarded the contracts could be anyone from an oligarch to someone who has profited from the conflict, right? So when we think about that, we want to make sure that we screen those business relationships to make sure that people who aren't war criminals, frankly, or associated with war criminals are not benefiting now in reconstruction. So that is an important role that whatever reconstruction and recovery agency monitors contracts will need to do partner screening. It's very important. You know, you don't want sanctions violators or so forth being the ones to benefit. Second piece is this idea, just again, that you want companies that are going to go in there and who will be responsible and will consider their impacts of their business models. This is not easy. And it, again, for any economy, but it's more challenging in post-conflict. But asking companies at least to make a commitment and perhaps at least, and Elena, I know your work recently has identified this, what are the biggest risks, right? As we think about different key sectors. So construction is going to be a big one. Transport. When we think about those, right, what are the risks, right? We say salient, but just what are the big human rights risks to people from the reconstruction? We know worker issues and worker safety, worker rights, labor issues are going to be important. So we need to deal with those and make sure that there are protections in place. So again, nothing will be perfect, but at least identifying where those risks are and trying to select companies that have at least some commitment to this larger issue, because the massive scale of reconstruction means that, you know, we'll be dealing with companies who will have a huge impact on the daily lives of people.
I agree. And also, I see one more challenge. You know, we don't have a really strong tradition actually to involve different stakeholders. And as we know, human rights due diligence actually needs to have such involvement. And yeah, what do you recommend for different actors of Ukraine, for civil society organizations, for governmental institutions in this regard?
Yeah. Well, I think I'd actually start, before I get to civil society and government, I think the first place to start is actually with companies. That, you know, we're actually chatting now right before, well, the Ukraine Recovery Conference is going on in England, and there is a set of companies that are taking a pledge to support reconstruction. So a conversation needs to begin with those companies to say, what are you doing to think about issues of human rights and responsible business conduct? So we should be starting now with those discussions and asking certain companies to be leaders and champions in thinking through how they will implement respect for human rights in recovery. They shouldn't just get sort of a, you know, congratulations for kind of being companies that support recovery, but should support responsible recovery. As part of that, I think the next piece can be that the government has an important convening role. So there's, of course, the Ukrainian government, most important, but there are also donor governments. And sort of their encouragement to convene those multi-stakeholder conversations right now with key Ukrainian civil society partners and possibly some international human rights organizations to help develop a plan. Mm-hmm. Now, the UN, and again, there is conflict still going on in Syria, but the UN, as it is thinking about reconstruction in Syria, has embedded or has made reference to the UN guiding principles as part of reconstruction plans. Mm-hmm. So my hope is, we haven't seen that yet, but within Ukraine, that we will start to see that. We have to begin the conversation now in mm-hmm. order to be ready for that those future efforts.
Yeah, I totally agree. And thank you for this point. And I really hope that we will see it. And my next question actually is about what challenges do you see as the most, you know, the most challenging things in this way? And the second, my question, you mentioned Ukrainian government and you mentioned some donors governments, but what about the European Union? No, of course, it's also as a could be considered as a government, but I'm wondering that having these initiatives on the directive on corporate sustainability due diligence. At the same time, we don't really see any, you know, message to Ukraine or to Moldova or to Georgia to make some efforts in this regard. So we see it's just as a parallel processes, you know, and I don't know why the European Union doesn't make such signs to countries which Moldova and Ukraine have this candidate status.
Yeah, so you've mentioned, I think, two important questions. The first one is the challenges. For any government, rule of law is a challenge in a post-conflict setting, right? Courts mm-hmm. are going to be tremendously stressed. And so the question is, what we need are accountability mechanisms, oversight and accountability. And that's the big challenge for reconstruction. Large mm-hmm. amounts of money, large government contracts, money spent quickly. How do you monitor, oversee, et cetera? So I think it's for the international community to start to develop and basically look at what would be good oversight mechanisms. And they usually involve kind of key independent auditors within the government or in some mm-hmm. kind of reconstruction agency. So some kind of oversight mechanism, possibly alternative kind of tribunals or dispute resolution in the event there is a problem. But it's sort of working with Ukraine to say, what are those accountability mechanisms? Mm-hmm. While simultaneously investing, as you've mentioned, Elena, in basic support for the courts to be as well functioning in the commercial context in particular mm-hmm. As well. In terms of the European Union, I think one of the reasons, and I would hope that with recovery, we'll see more attention through external action and partnership on mm-hmm. technical cooperation with Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia. Mm-hmm. I think it will happen. What you're seeing now as we are talking is that in the European Union, right, they're just beginning the tri-party negotiation on the directive on, mm-hmm, on corporate mm-hmm. sustainability due diligence. Heightened human rights due diligence, the whole concept of that sort of higher standard in conflict, and that would include mm-hmm. post-conflict settings, is kind of step one, right? That would create, for many of the companies we're talking about who will be doing work mm-hmm. in Ukraine, that extra layer. So that mm-hmm. they will have to do that human rights due diligence. And mm-hmm. if not, there may be consequences. So I think that that debate is still playing out. And so let's hope, fingers crossed, we see that remain. I think alongside that, you're starting to see in the trade and investment debate or agenda, that discussion of the need for appropriate enhancements and measures for partner countries. Mm-hmm. So I think it's more just about timing. And I would say that, again, for you and others who are Ukrainian scholars and advocates, you're doing the right thing. And, making that case now about you need more than the directive just mm-hmm. on paper.
Yeah, thank you very much for this comment. And you mentioned oligarchs and oligarchs companies, and you know I have this dilemma for some period of time. We still have of course companies which have this oligarchs past, but actually these companies are operating quite successfully in Ukrainian market more or less, and they don't recognize that they had this negative impact on political system of Ukraine, on human rights environment in Ukraine, on the rule of law environment in Ukraine. And now some of them pretend to be even something like a responsible business conduct champions. And I'm just thinking about what is the good solution of this situation. From one side, they are trying to do right things. From another side, they don't recognize their negative past. I'm just wondering, should we believe them and just support them in their positive efforts, or should we make some pressure on public opinion on these companies that before you are starting to be responsible business and for being a responsible business, you should recognize that you had this negative impact on political system of Ukraine?
You're a great professor, Elena, with a very hard question. So here's my answer, and it's one that acknowledges that moments of post-conflict are also transitional times, right? And so if we think about principles of transitional justice, so there's the immediate part, right, which is that what Ukraine and many economies need to sort of be resilient and strong after war is they need sort of open, transparent, and competitive markets, right? That you want all businesses, because as we think about it, right, the oligarch based companies historically are actually stronger and able to continue now, whereas smaller companies and companies that have never benefited from kind of cutting corners are struggling, right? So I think there's sort of two pieces to this. One is that the government and donors will need to, I think, provide incentives for smaller local companies that have been harmed by the conflict. So giving them priority because they have either been harmed before or didn't have those advantages that an oligarch-based economic enterprise did. So that's my first response. My second one is that moving forward in the short term, it may be about making sure that the future economic transactions are as protected and as competitive and open as possible, right? And I'll get to the past in a minute. So that's my sort of like, no matter what, looking forward, I think trying to rectify the harm to businesses that played and competed honestly, right? And those tend to be smaller businesses and so forth. And so coming up with special incentives and programs to help them. Second one is to make sure that future contracting and economic processes are as strong and open as possible. And then that third question about what to do about the past is truly one that is political, right? So it's not for me to say, it really is for Ukraine and the Ukrainian people to decide if and when they're going to address those issues. Meaning that if you can move forward in a more transparent and fair way, the fact that previously certain businesses benefited from their close relationships to politicians or got contracts based on relationships, or were able to get a government license for a company, and they got their wealth through this influence and relationship building. You know, could it be prosecuted? Maybe. Could they be stripped of their licenses? Possibly. But the resources for doing that will be significant. And when you start dealing with that kind of an issue, it becomes politically sensitive. So it's just to say, it could happen, but that is very much a decision that, like, I, you know, it is it's political. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I totally agree. And also, I see, you know, this link again with UN guiding principles, and even mostly with John Ruggie's framework about social expectations. No, yeah. So yeah, probably, it's about this moment when we will have this social request.
And that's just it. I mean, I think the larger issue for people who are, you know, historians, political scientists, researchers, right, is, again, as a matter of transitional justice, is that part of moving forward is acknowledging, or at least somehow trying to recognize the company's past, how that happens and when it happens and what's the right framework for addressing kind of that previous injustice or unfairness is important. But you know, as we're seeing in many countries, right? I mean, we're still dealing with the legacy of colonial, right? Privilege that companies have, and we still haven't sorted that out. So it's something we should just not forget, but doesn't mean that it'll be addressed quickly.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you for this response. It really makes sense for us. Probably my final question, I can't stop myself to ask you about it. I think that you know that in our region, business and human rights agenda is replaced by social corporate responsibility agenda. And now when we are trying to talk with companies about business and human rights, we start this conversation with business and human rights risks, and you have these business and human rights risks in your operations, but companies take these conversations very, very hard because in their mind, they are doing a lot to support Ukrainians, and we even have such a label as brave Ukrainian business. And when you try, to speak with them, something like they take it as a criticism of them, and that's why I'm still struggling how to communicate about business and human rights and human rights risks with companies which have this kind of thinking, and probably absolutely understandable kind of thinking in these circumstances.
Yeah, I agree with you that it is understandable. And it's not just in the context of the Russian war of aggression, right? That you have these ideas of brave kind of companies stepping up in situations of natural disasters, right? If there's an earthquake or there's some kind of major issue, or even the pandemic, right? That companies will step up and often provide positive aid, right? They, if they're a food company, they provide food. If they're a, pharmaceutical. And I think part of beginning that conversation is to say, yes, they are addressing human suffering and the public good, right? So that is a form of help, and it's very important. But then I think it's just to say that they will continue to be credited and recognized for that. But the business and human rights agenda is doing two things. One is, and Elena, your work has been groundbreaking here, in the context of conflict, there are very specific risks to people. You know, if you're a utility company or a food company or a grocery store, right, suddenly you have different issues and really difficult decisions that have day-to-day impact. So I think talking about the urgency of those decisions, but then the longer term, and I think that's what you're asking about, is like, why would they want to invest in the UN guiding principles and all of these sort of technical things when they're just so busy dealing with the immediate crisis and trying to do good? I think that's really back to the discussion of, in the future, as the economy needs to be rebuilt and you want a strong Ukraine, this is true of any country, you want to invest in those business and human rights processes because it will make your workers safer and sounder. It will make you more attractive to international markets, right? That this expectation is not going to go away. So don't ignore it, because it will be what makes you a more attractive company and your country a more attractive market. the fact that you are dealing with these issues that can negatively impact your supply chain, right? And mm-hmm. and your workers and your company. So I think it's about this sort of resilience and the fact that in the future, companies that are competitive, transparent, mm-hmm. and who have invested in human rights will be the ones that will be chosen. And that's, I think, the bigger piece of that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. And actually, amazing responses. And I hope that your messages will be heard by many actors in Ukraine and beyond of Ukraine, because it's really, really important to see. So thank you. Thank you very much, Anita.
Well, and thank you so much, Elena. And again, it's been a pleasure for me to learn from you, because I think, again, you know, your research is really looking at the specific situations for companies. And I think that that evidence base is so important as we try to make these more theoretical arguments. So thank you for all the work you're doing.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you for your support. And it's really important to know that we have such support as yours. So thank you.
Great. Thanks so much. Yeah.